Welcome to Hanschuk Targets History. I'm your host, Tim Hanschuk. Thanks for joining me this episode. You know, I've been teaching high school history for way too many years, and I love talking about this stuff. So let me share with you some interesting, unique, and little-known historical events. I know you'll be entertained, and if you're not careful, you just might learn something too. So, let's lock and load and take a shot at that target of history and see what we can hit. Well, let's take a walk down range and see what the target shows us. Hey, we hit in the World War II area, specifically an Allied deception called Operation Mincemeat. Wow, talk about a really bizarre wartime event. This is certainly one. This is one of the most freaky things to come out of World War II. So let's see what happened. So we're in World War II, and the Anglo-American Allies had invaded North Africa in November of 1942. This was, of course, Operation Torch, and was the start of the North African campaign. Now, with this campaign's success, a meeting of the Allied leaders was held at Casablanca in January of 43. This was the Casablanca Conference, and was attended by American President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union was invited, but he couldn't attend because the Soviets were in the middle of a major offensive at this time, namely, the end of the encirclement and destruction of the German Sixth Army at a little place called Stalingrad. Anyway, Roosevelt and Churchill discussed, among other things, what to do next. They knew a cross-channel invasion into occupied France wouldn't be ready to take place until 1944. So Churchill wanted to use the Allied forces in North Africa to strike at what he called Europe's soft underbelly. In other words, strike somewhere from the Mediterranean into southern Europe. There were two possible targets they could use: Sicily, which would be a stepping stone into mainland Italy, or the Balkans, specifically Greece. Churchill favored hitting Greece. He felt that Sicily was too obvious a target, and that an attack into the Balkans would trap a large number of German forces between the Anglo-American invaders and the Soviets in the east. Churchill didn't get his way. Instead, Allied planners chose to invade Sicily, codenamed Operation Husky, with a start time of no later than July of that year. The Allies knew that this was a rather obvious target, but they also knew that Hitler was very much afraid of a Balkan invasion, because that was an area from which Germany got a lot of raw materials for its war effort. To play on this fear, the Allies launched a deception called Operation Barclay to mislead the Germans into thinking the Balkans were their true target. They did the usual kind of sneaky stuff. They set up a fictional army formation in Egypt. They used false radio traffic to and from its imaginary headquarters, so it seemed like a lot of activity was going on there. Meanwhile, the real HQ for Operation Husky, which was in Tunis, reduced their radio traffic by using landlines as much as possible. They also openly stockpiled Greek maps and currency and called for Greek interpreters. As part of the larger deception of Operation Barclay, Operation Mincemeat came into being. To understand what it was and how it came about, we need to backtrack a bit. In late September of 1939, just after the war had started, British Rear Admiral John Godfrey, who was the Director of Naval Intelligence, circulated a paper that became known as the Trout Memo. It was a list of possible schemes to deceive the enemy, and it was called the Trout Memo because it compared all those possible deceptions to fly fishing for trout. Now, even though the memo was published in Godfrey's name, evidence suggests that it was actually written by his personal assistant, Lieutenant Commander Ian Fleming. Yeah, that Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. By the way, it's widely assumed that M from the Bond series was based on Godfrey. But anyway, idea number 28 on the list was simply titled A Suggestion, not a very nice one. It outlined an idea to plant false papers on a corpse that would be found by the enemy. Now, as freaky as that sounds, it wasn't an original idea. The British and many others had used similar things in World War I and also already in this war. It even had a name. It was called the Haversack Ruse. In October of 1942, British intelligence officer Flight Lieutenant Charles Cholmondeley put together his own version of Number 28 from the Trout Memo. Basically, he proposed getting a body from a London hospital, dressing it as an officer, and planting false papers on it. Then a coastal command plane would drop it in the ocean in such a place where it would wash up on a beach for the enemy to find. The idea being that, oh, it must have been a passenger on a plane that crashed in the ocean, and oh, here the body washed up. In early November, just as the invasion of North Africa was taking place, Cholmondeley presented this plan that he titled Trojan Horse to the British Intelligence Committee. They called it unworkable and turned it down, but did feel it had some potential. So they assigned Ewan Montague, an officer with naval intelligence, to work with Cholmondeley to see if the plan could be developed further. As they kicked around new ideas, Montague talked with Sir Bernard Spilsbury, a pathologist, to get an idea of what type of body they should be looking for and what factors they'd have to take into account to fool a Spanish pathologist. Montague and Cholmondeley had both believed they'd need a corpse with fluid in its lungs so it would look like a drowning. But Spilsbury told them no. Many victims of a plane crash, even into water, die from shock, not drowning. So it wouldn't really matter if the lungs were full of water or not. This was good news, as it increased the odds of this plan working, because it had way more possible bodies from which to choose. Montague then talked to Bentley Purchase, who was the coroner for the Northern District of London, about getting a body. He even commented, quote, "I should think bodies are the only commodity not in short supply at the moment. I mean, hey, there was a war going on, you know?" Purchase told him that it wasn't that simple. Apart from finding a body that would fit the deception, they also had to find one they could legally use. In other words, one who had no relatives to claim it for burial. This being said, Purchase did agree to keep his eyes open for any possibilities. On the 28th of January, 1943, Purchase contacted Montague, saying he had a suitable body. It was that of a homeless Welsh tramp named Glyndwr Michael. He had died from ingesting rat poison. Ouch. But Purchase ensured Montague and Cholmondeley that such a small amount of poison would not be identified in a body that had been floating in the sea for a couple days before washing up on shore. Purchase agreed to keep the body in his mortuary fridge, being careful not to allow it to freeze. That would have been obvious to any pathologist. He also warned Montague and Cholmondeley that they had to use the body in the next 3 months or it would be too decomposed to work in the plan. Montague chose mincemeat as the code name for the operation. No, he didn't come up with it himself. He just picked it off a list of available names for intelligence operations. On the 4th of February, 1943, he and Cholmondeley submitted their plan to the Intelligence Committee. It was basically Cholmondeley's Trojan horse reworked. They'd place false documents on the corpse and float it so it would wash up on the Spanish coast. They chose Spain because even though Spain was officially neutral in the war, they were known to cooperate with German military intelligence. The mincemeat plan was approved, and Montague and Cholmondeley were told to continue their work. The next step was to create a legend, a fictional identity and backstory for the body. They chose the name William Martin and gave him the rank of Captain Acting Major of the Royal Marines. They chose Martin because it was a somewhat common name in Britain. The rank of Acting Major would make him senior enough to be carrying the fake sensitive documents, but not too senior where anyone would expect to know him. They chose the Royal Marines because their officers would travel in battle dress, which came in standard sizes and was easier to obtain than a tailor-made dress uniform for any other service branch's officers. They also set about creating what's known as wallet or pocket litter. meaning all those little details that you'd find in someone's wallet or pockets. They invented a fiancé named Pam and created two love letters she sent him and a photograph. The pic was actually a clerk in the intelligence office. There was a letter from his father, a receipt from a London jewelry store for an engagement ring, presumably for Pam, a bill from his bank for an overdraft, a note from the family solicitor. All of these things do create a nice backstory, but remember, the body of Martin was going to be floating in the ocean for a few days, and the effort in creating all this stuff would be worthless if they became illegible. To deal with this, Montague and Cholmondeley had MI5 scientists research what inks would last longest in the water, and they used those. Also included in Martin's pockets were a book of stamps, a silver cross, a St. Christopher medal, cigarettes, matches, keys, a receipt for a recently purchased shirt to create the illusion that he'd been recently in London before flying back to North Africa on his supposed ill-fated flight. They added dated theater ticket stubs from a London show and a bill for four nights lodging at the Navy and Military Club. A big challenge Montague and Cholmondeley faced was the photo ID cards that Major Martin would be carrying. Guess what? You can take a picture of a corpse, but no matter how hard you try, you can't make it look like the person is alive. And Montague and Cholmondeley certainly tried. Instead, they lucked out and they found an MI5 officer who looked enough like Martin to pass in the photographs. To give the ID cards that used sheen kind of look, Montague spent the next few days rubbing them with a cloth. As for the uniform, Cholmondeley, who was about the same size, wore it for a number of weeks to also give it a worn look. Of course, the most important thing to be placed on Martin's body would be the false documents that would mislead the Germans. Montague established three criteria for the main letter. It had to casually but clearly identify the Balkans as the intended invasion site. It had to name Sicily and another location as decoys, and it had to be an unofficial letter. An official communication would have been sent by diplomatic courier or coded signal. To meet these criteria, a letter was written purportedly from Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Nye, who was in England, to General Sir Harold Alexander, commander of the 18th Army Group in North Africa under Eisenhower. It spoke of a number of subjects and worked in all the information Montague wanted, while appearing to be a personal communication between two old buddies. On top of this, a letter of introduction was written from Martin's supposed commanding officer, referring to him as an amphibious warfare expert on loan until the assault was over. A concern that Montague and Cholmondeley had was, what if the Spanish didn't bother to look in the corpse's pockets? These false documents, the whole point of the operation, might be overlooked. To remedy this, they decided to put the documents in an official briefcase. But two letters, one personal, really wouldn't justify the use of a briefcase and could alert the Germans that this was some kind of scam. To justify using a briefcase, two proof copies of the official pamphlet on combined operations that would be distributed to British and American soldiers were included, along with a letter asking Eisenhower to write a brief foreword for the pamphlet's American edition. To prevent the briefcase from floating away while in the water, a leather-covered chain, a lot like what bank couriers used in those days, attached the case to Martin. Cholmondeley and Montague then selected the place where Martin's body was to be found. After talking to Navy scientists about tides and currents, they chose Huelva on the southern coast of Spain. This was an ideal location because the British vice consul in the city, Francis Hazelden, would be very reliable in playing his part in the operation. There was also a known German agent operating in that area, guaranteeing that German intelligence would get wind of it immediately. It was decided to use a submarine to deliver the corpse, because trying to drop it from a low-flying plane seemed way too problematic, and a surface ship might attract attention and might even be attacked. But using a sub meant the body had to be transported for a week or more. This meant it needed some type of container that was airtight and would keep it as fresh as possible. Cholmondeley contacted the pathologist Spilsbury again to find the requirements needed for such a container, then had the Ministry of Supply build one. It was labeled Optical Instruments, Handle with Care. Operation Mincemeat received its final go-ahead in the early morning hours of April 17, 1943. Montague and Cholmondeley dressed the body, struggling with the boots, because hey, it's not easy to dress a corpse. They added the pocket litter and briefcase and loaded it into the container. They also put in 20 pounds of dry ice. The science behind this, of which I'm not very knowledgeable, is that when the dry ice sublimated, it would fill the container with carbon dioxide and thus preserve the body without any further refrigeration. Huh, who knew? Montague and Cholmondeley placed the container in the back of a van and rode with it as Jacques Horsfall, a racing champ before the war, drove it at breakneck speed from London all the way up to Greenock in Scotland. There, the container was loaded onto the HMS Seraph, commanded by Lieutenant Bill Jewell. Jewell and the Seraph had some special ops experience, and Jewell told his men that the container held a top-secret meteorological device they'd be deploying near Spain. Now sailors, especially submariners, are a superstitious lot, and many of the men began to half-jokingly say that the mysterious container labeled Optical Instruments really looked like a coffin. Oh, little did they know. The Seraph set sail on the 19th of April and reached the coast off Spain on the 29th. It had been bombed twice during this trip. After checking out the coastline, the Seraph surfaced at about 4:15 in the morning on April 30th. Jewell had the container brought on deck. Then all crew except for the officers were ordered below. The body was lowered into the water, as respectfully as you could do something like that, I guess, while Jewell read Psalm 39. Jewell then ordered the engines full astern, using the wash from the screws to push the floating body toward the shore. And the deed was done. The body of Major Martin was found later that morning by a local fisherman and taken by Spanish soldiers to Huelva. Vice Consul Hasselden was informed, and he cabled the Admiralty back in London. Thus began a series of scripted messages sent back and forth between Hasselden and London over the next several days. See, the British knew these messages would be intercepted, and even though they were encrypted, the British also knew the Germans had broken this code. So it's one of those, we know you know what you think we know kind of situations. So the point of these messages was to play out the idea that it was crucial Hasselden get this highly important briefcase back. On May 1st, an autopsy was performed on Major Martin's body. Hasselden was present, and to try to lessen the possibility the Spanish doctors would realize they were looking at a three-month-old corpse, he suggested that with the heat of the day and the reek of the corpse, maybe they should just end the post-mortem and go have lunch. The doctors agreed, since it seemed pretty obvious to them that the man had drowned, and that's what they put on the death certificate. Martin's body was buried the next day in a Huelva cemetery with full military honors, and they're at rest to this day, by the way. As for the briefcase, the Spanish Navy held on to it, and they sent it to naval headquarters at San Fernando and then on to Madrid. The Germans, having totally believed the false exchange of cables that they'd intercepted, desperately wanted to get their hands on this case, so much so that the head of German intelligence, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, personally intervened with the Spanish authorities and asked for copies of the documents. The Spanish agreed. Now the letters in the briefcase were each in a wax-sealed envelope. The Spanish were able to extract each letter by somehow winding it around a probe and sliding it out from the side of the envelope flap, way more sleight of hand than I could ever imagine. They photographed the documents, then reinserted them back into the envelopes the same way, leaving the wax seals intact. On May 11th, the Spanish turned over the intact briefcase to Hazelden, who forwarded it to London in a diplomatic bag. There, forensic experts examined the letters and were able to determine that though the seals had not been broken, the letters had indeed been removed and then put back. A scripted cable, again in a code the Germans could break, was sent to Hazelden saying the case had arrived and the documents were untampered with and everything was cool. This was, of course, to fool the Germans into thinking the British didn't know the letters had been looked at. So, did this operation succeed? Were the Germans fooled? The answer is a definite yes. Check out this evidence. Remember, British code breakers at Bletchley Park had broken the German Enigma code, so German communications were being read. And a message from the 12th of May, read by the Brits on the 14th, showed them that the Germans believed the Allied invasion would come in the Balkans because of the false information they got from mincemeat. Furthermore, throughout the rest of May and June, the Germans moved one panzer division from France to the Balkans and pulled two more off the Eastern Front. German torpedo boats left Sicily for the Balkans, and 17 infantry divisions were moved into that general area. When Operation Husky began on the 9th of July, and the Allies were actually invading Sicily, Hitler still believed it was just a feint, so much so that 4 hours into the invasion, saw him ordering 21 planes out of Sicily to go reinforce Greece. And later in July, as the fighting raged in Sicily, he sent one of the great German generals of World War II, Erwin Rommel, to Salonika to prepare a defense of the area. Let's face it, by the time the German high command realized they'd been duped, it was too late. Now, having said all that, was the tremendous success the Allies enjoyed in Sicily completely due to mincemeat or even the larger Barclay deception? No, of course not. Mincemeat certainly contributed, and it was one of the most successful single deception operations of the entire war, and probably the freakiest. But a host of other factors played roles as well. But talking about them, that would be another story. And there you have it, kind listeners. Thank you for tuning in. If you like this episode, please tell your friends about it. And I very much look forward to talking with you again in our next episode.